Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And our guest today may not be a stranger to many of our listeners. If you've been to any appellate CLEs in the last decade or so, you've probably seen him speak, but I bet he still has plenty to teach us today. It's Chad Baruch from Johnston Toby Baruch in Dallas. Chad, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Chad, for those of us who know you, we know a lot about you, but I think some of our listeners would enjoy hearing a little bit more about your background and kind of how you got to where you are today.
Well, legal or otherwise,
as yes, you know, I've had both. Yeah, you have an interesting background, legal yeah. and non-legal.
ADD career. Okay, so I have been engaged in the half to full-time practice of law continuously for about 30 years since I graduated in 1991. I started with a downtown firm in litigation in Dallas, figured out pretty quickly that wasn't for me, went out on my own, was a solo for a little over 20 years. And during that time, made the transition from litigation to exclusively appellate. That's all I do at this point is, some attorney grievance work and some judicial misconduct work, but some election work. But in terms of, no litigation is what I'm trying to say. And then about 5 years ago, I joined with the guys at Johnston Toby and essentially just moved my appellate practice into their legal malpractice and legal ethics practice. So they continue to do legal malpractice and ethics. And then I do, as I say, grievance, judicial misconduct, and appellate. So that's been the law side of it. And of course, I've been very active in the state bar for the past 15 or 20 years, served in my second term on the state bar board of directors. Presently, I'm serving as chair of the state bar. And in 2017, of course, got the great opportunity to travel across the state and run for bar president. So that's sort of the legal side of it. And then almost that entire 30 years, I've been teaching and coaching. Taught government both at the high school and college level, government teacher in high school, political science professor at the college level, and then was high school basketball coach for many years, and then both an NAIA and NCAA Division III head basketball coach. So for the first time, these last 5 years, really, or last 4 years, are the only time in my entire legal career that I've been engaged in the practice of law and not teaching or coaching. I'm a full-time lawyer for the first time in my life. So.
Yeah, you've always been one of those guys that I would see you online and I'd be like, how does he do this? Because I remember when you were coaching and you clearly enjoyed the heck out of what you were doing. And I think maybe we're even good at it for an added bonus, right? But it amazes me when I see some of the things that you've done above and beyond, the day-to-day of practicing law. That's just really neat.
Well, as you guys know, appellate practice is probably one of the few practices you could do it with, because as long as you're online and have your laptop, you can practice appellate law. And so I cannot tell you the number of briefs I have written or the amount of legal research I have done on buses traveling across Louisiana and Oklahoma and New Mexico. And, even at times the players would laugh at me because even before games, sometimes they would be out warming up and I'd be in the locker room with a dictaphone. That's an absolutely true story. I kid you not.
Wait, with a what?
Yeah, right. hey, guys, look.
Is that like a cell phone? I don't know what that means.
My handy dandy dictaphone right there. I still use that, baby. It's just now I plug it in instead of giving it to someone.
I can't say you're showing your age because I'm right there with you, man. But you're showing your generation, I guess, is maybe what is more accurate, because don't most people just use their iPhone for that now?
I'm sure that could be done, but you have way overshot my technological ability there. I'm still in the Stone Age. I will freely admit that when it comes to technology. But it's funny how sometimes the two careers have intersected or overlapped. Just in many ways over the years, but, I remember one time a referee sidling up to me during a stopping the action and telling me, hey, aren't you involved in the state bar? And I said, yeah. And he said, I was the point guard when Tom Vick was the power forward. We played college basketball together.
Oh, that's great.
The year Tom was state bar president. You know, it's just, it's kind of funny.
Do you ever find yourself blowing a whistle in an oral argument or anything?
not so much. I've wanted to a few times. Yeah,
I imagine.
I was just doing a little homework before we started today. I mean, I've known you for quite a while, and Jody has too. But, you know, one of the things I noticed from digging around in your bio is you did not start off in Texas, at least in terms of your education. Where did you grow up? I'm just curious.
I grew up in central Wisconsin.
Okay. And then you stayed up there and went to school. So when you came to Texas, it was to take that job with the law firm in 91.
Yeah, my folks both had grown up in Texas. We had spent every summer of my life in the panhandle. My mom's from Pampa. My dad's a Holocaust survivor, originally from Germany, but he grew up in Galveston. And so I knew from the time I was probably 5 years old that I was a displaced Texan and wanted to be here.
Got here as fast as you could.
Got here as fast as I could, as they say. In my case, it's exactly true.
Spend less time analyzing data and more time digging into the facts with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. Powered by the largest collection of federal and state dockets, litigation analytics instantly aggregates data points to produce information such as likely timeline, outcomes, representation, and damages from which you can base your case strategy and assess potential litigation costs and resources and position yourself for success. Gain a strategic edge using data-driven insights with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. Before we jump too much into talking about legal writing and kind of the legal practice, let's spend a few minutes on the bar, if you don't mind, just kind of running down what the State Bar Board does and what you now do, your role as State Bar Board Chair, what that kind of means to those of us practicing lawyers out here.
Sure. You know, I sort of have two jobs to tell you what it means to be State Bar Chair. One is simply to facilitate the board's work. And the other is I'm like the fourth string quarterback. So we have a bar president-elect, and a bar past president. And if someone from the State Bar needs to make an appearance and none of the first three stringers can get there, I'm the next man up. And in my case, the first man up, because all three of our present presidents, of course, are women for the first time in the history of the State Bar, which is a great thing. So that's really what I do, is just try to facilitate the board's work. The board literally has oversight responsibility for every aspect of the State Bar. And, you know, I get frustrated. Sometimes people will say, oh, it's high school student council. And I say, my goodness, I don't know what high school you went to, but mine didn't have a $50 million budget. You know, we have over 500 employees. We have over a $50 million budget. There are nearly 10,000 families in Texas who depend on us for their children to be able to go to the doctor when they're sick because they have their health insurance through the State Bar. There are 250,000 Texas school children every year who are educated by a government or civics teacher that we have trained, the State Bar of Texas. I mean, it's an enormous entity with a lot of moving parts. The grievance system, obviously, is under the oversight of the board. The client assistance program is under the board's oversight. TLAP, our program that assists lawyers in crisis. We have a new program. Our incoming bar president, or recently inaugurated bar president, Laura Gibson, is really looking to expand. We have a program designed to help the families of solo practitioners who pass away. You know, to leave behind your family, none of them are lawyers. They don't know anything about confidentiality, privilege, closing client files, trust accounts. So we're expanding this program that will help the families of those folks. So it's just that, you know, it's an enormous organization, and the board, through its various board committees, has responsibility to oversee all of that.
And you mentioned having run for president back in 2017. So, you know, Texas lawyers who are listening to this or who aren't appellate lawyers, aside from the fact that you managed to get yourself, you know, profiled in the legal media sometimes, not infrequently because of your excellent work as an appellate lawyer, they think they've heard of you. That may be one reason why, is you may have shaken their hand going around office to office 5 years ago or so, which I can't believe it's been that long.
I mean, there's no way to get a really accurate count, but our best estimate is I personally met somewhere between 25 and 30,000 lawyers in 2017, which by the way, was a great, I mean, it was an incredibly tiring experience. It was grueling, and I'm a bit of a germaphobe, so it was disgusting, but it was an amazing experience to get to meet that many folks and talk to them and hear their concerns. It was awesome. Really, truly awesome.
It's really a cool experience. You know, another thing that people may not realize that they know you for, but I feel like was in the media a little bit and then also has been featured some CLEs was the hip hop brief. You want to talk about the hip hop brief a little bit?
Yeah. So, and that kind of brings me to another topic I was hoping to visit with you guys about or share with folks is, you know, the biggest advances in my career all have been, with maybe one exception, all have been pro bono work. I took very early on, I got very good advice to get board certified when I decided I wanted to be a full-time appellate lawyer, get board certified. I did that. That was remarkable just because I had to learn so darn much appellate law. But I took two cases. One of them was actually through the appellate state bar appellate sections pro bono program. And with no strategic design, I just took the two cases because I was asked to take these cases. So they both had constitutional components. And I've done a lot of constitutional work over the years, First Amendment work. And both of them ended up ripening into pretty interesting adventures in the United States Supreme Court. But more importantly, with no design on my part, one of them ripened into co-counseling with Tom Phillips, Ted Cruz, and Allison Ho, and the other one ripened into co-counseling with Erwin Chemerinsky. And ultimately, because of that first experience, we ended up doing it a second time and a third time over the years. So, and I just cannot even begin to describe the education being part of a team with lawyers that good. And I just learned so much from all of them. And I would have to say, Erwin in particular, his humility and his sort of commitment to teamwork, like he's just the consummate teammate. There's no ego involved. He's just wonderfully supportive. And those experiences all came to me because I was willing to do those cases pro bono. And hip hop brief, unquestionably the same thing. I mean, the number of young lawyers who shook my hand and said, "You're the hip hop guy" in 2017 was stunning. I mean, just stunning. And I got just two nights ago, a professor out east contacted me and said, "There's a hip hop conviction happening in East Texas. Would you be willing to consult with the lawyers out there? Because the prosecution's trying to hang hip hop lyrics around them on a murder case." That brief has been an amazing, you know, force in my career. And again, it was just a pro bono case. I mean, I said, "Yeah, I'll do it." So, you know, pro bono is rewarding in more ways than one. Sometimes you can do well by doing good.
That's right. Well, you forever ingrained yourself as the hippest, coolest appellate lawyer around. None of us could ever touch that, I think.
Mm-hmm. My kids find it so amusing because it really is true. If you Google hip hop lawyer, you get me. I know nothing, right? Other than what I learned through the representation. My wife and I were lying in bed a few years ago watching a Will Ferrell movie, and she finally looked at me and she goes, "You know that's your client, right?" And I was like, "No, what do you?" She goes, "That's T.I. You're representing that guy." "No, not a clue. Not, he could have walked in the room and I wouldn't have known who he was." But so, no, I am not the hippest guy out there.
No, no. Todd said you were the hippest appellate lawyer. That's a different threshold. Let's be clear about that.
Yeah. It's, you know, let's do a Venn diagram.
Yeah.
It's a small sliver.
It was great fun, though. And I will say, I mean, I think it's a fabulous brief. And I wrote very little of it, to be truthful. Michael Render, Killer Mike, the rap artist, he and a professor out at Richmond, University of Richmond, named Eric Nielsen, really took the laboring oar on that and did a fabulous job. The hardest part, I tell lawyers, the hardest part of that brief actually was the Blue Book, because the Blue Book is about a decade behind the music industry. It tells you to cite to record labels, and nobody releases any music on a record label anymore, right? And they just drop it.
Yeah.
And so we were kind of just making up site forms as we were going through for some of this stuff.
Yeah, I hear my kids talking about that all the time. "Oh, so-and-so." And they happen to listen to some of that genre of music. "Oh, Drake's dropping a new album tonight." What?
Yeah.
What does that even mean?
And as I say, the Blue Book hasn't quite caught up to that.
Wow.
They're telling you to put Columbia Records 2022. It's like, I don't think so.
Wow. It just shows you how fast the world changes and how slowly the law moves and how slowly the lawyers move along with it. Well, one of the things, aside from just you being super appellate lawyer and on top of that, a super nice human and being very involved in the bar and a leader in all of those ways, one thing that you had done within the last year that kind of caught my attention, maybe I'll just tell a little story on you here for just a second. And anybody who knows you will not be surprised by this at all. But last fall, we finally got to reconvene the Advanced Appellate Seminar here in Austin. And, you know, I've gotten used to, Chad, over the years, seeing you dressed in some what seems to be a really ridiculous costume. You know, if you Google Chad, you'll probably find him in like a Patrick Henry-esque suit when he was going and re-arguing or doing a dramatization of, I guess it was Marbury versus Madison, which is amazing. But, and then when we were together recently, he showed up in, I think it was a Saturday Night Live cheerleader skit outfit. You can explain that if you want to, but where I'm going with this is we're at a conference here in Austin with probably about 300 appellate lawyers and judges. And the appellate judges do attend our conferences. I see you walking down the hall in a Buzz Lightyear costume. I've learned these things don't shock me anymore, by the way. I'm like, well, there's Chad. He's just being Chad. The wonderful thing about it was I came to realize that you had written a paper for that seminar. And here's the tie-in. It's, you know, it was called To Infinity and Beyond. Therefore, the Buzz Lightyear reference, Legal Writing for a New Generation of Appellate Judges. I attended your presentation that day and thought, of course, that you did a great job. But, you know, we can't really talk enough about legal writing on this show. And we actually haven't talked about it as much as we should have. And so, of course, I see you, you know, fairly often. And I happen to think, huh, I wonder if Chad would come on and talk to us about legal writing because you know a thing or two about it. And you do it in a way that I think is different. And I mean that in a good way. So we'd like to spend some time talking with you today about not just going through that paper point by point, because that would be really dull. And you might be able to find a way to spice it up. But if I did it, it would be dull. And so, but that's kind of the focus of our conversation. And of course, our timing is interesting too, because the new Lightyear movie is coming out or has come out like this week. No comment on that. But let's just kind of talk about that subject. Let me let you sort of lead the discussion about your passion for legal writing, how you got into that and how you grew to become, you know, an appellate lawyer at sort of a more fundamental level. You said litigation was not your thing. How did you gravitate toward appellate law?
Oh, I was lucky. My best friend is a law professor at SMU, and he basically just sat me down one day and said, "You're in the wrong business, dude. Like, your skill set is appellate law and you're constitutional makeup. Like, litigation just makes my stomach hurt. I walk into a trial courtroom and I get a stomach ache. I don't like conflict. I mean, I enjoy competition, but I don't like conflict, right?" Mm-hmm. And so that was really a big part of it. It was like litigation was just slowly crushing my soul. And appellate law, as you guys know, is very little conflict and all about the law and writing. And I love to write. Both of my parents were college professors. Both of them were in the fields of literature. My dad was Greek and Shakespearean tragedy. My mom was kind of straight up English. So I grew up in a house where, you know, reading and writing were important. So I've always been super interested in writing and just got more and more interested over the years. And the Buzz Lightyear presentation really was a recognition. It was spurred by what happened here in Dallas with our Court of Appeals. All of a sudden, we had all these young lawyers on our Court of Appeals. And I realized that, you know, and on our trial bench, even younger than that, and I realized, oh my gosh, I'm writing summary judgment motions, you know, helping lawyers write summary judgment motions for judges that are part of what I call the Toy Story generation. They're my son's age, right? They grew up on Toy Story. And that's just shocking. In fact, I'll tell you a funny story about it. For about 15 years, I was the assistant principal of a high school in Dallas. And back during the time when a lot of the state bar sections and other organizations were transitioning from paper newsletters to electronic newsletters, I believe the appellate law section went through that, right? When the advocate went electronic. Mm-hmm. The director of sections, Tracy Knuckles at the State Bar, asked me, would you be willing to come down to the Council of Chairs, which is the meeting of all the section chairs in the bar four times a year? Would you come talk to them about e-newsletters and e-journals and that conversion process? And I said, you know, Tracy, I don't know anything about it, but Hear me out. I said, I've got the editor of my high school newspaper, and we sent her up to New York this summer for a workshop on exactly that topic, because we're doing the same thing at the high school. What if I bring her? Because she knows a lot about it. So down we went. I had brought my 16-year-old junior editor, and she knocked that room dead with her discussion of the topic, so much so that they invited her back the next year. By the way, she is now the USA Today beat reporter on the Dallas Cowboys. Very, very proud of her, and has a show here, in fact, you know, a sports show here in Dallas. So that's kind of cool. But, you know, she talked a lot about this. She had a very funny PowerPoint that she, that in fact, that I stole some from for the Buzz Lightyear presentation, where she was just talking about, you know, the mammoth changes in reading and writing generationally. And I finally, at one point, I did interrupt her. I said, Jory, if you refer to the 20th century as an historical era one more time, we're done. Right? Like, we're out. But that, you know, all of those things were kind of what I was thinking of, was that, you know, we as lawyers, we're not changing. Our readers are changing. Our judges are changing, and we're not. It's, I liken it to what happened when we went to e-file. You know, that's probably the most significant change in legal practice, certainly in my career, probably maybe since the adoption of the civil procedure rules themselves. I mean, that was a sea change in day-to-day legal practice, right? I mean, just mammoth. In response to that, 99% of lawyers did nothing. I mean, they wrote and formatted exactly as if they were stapling it and two-holing it and putting it in a binder and, you know, not thinking about the fact at all that nobody's reading it in a binder. And now it's more than that. You know, a lot of these judges are reading it on an iPad. They're not even reading it on a laptop or a desktop. You know, we should be changing how we do things, and we're not. And I think the same is true generationally. Younger readers, different expectations than older readers. And we're, as Todd says, very slow to adapt. So that was sort of the genesis of the Buzz Lightyear. And plus, I just love putting on a costume and making everybody chuckle, you know, in the middle of a CLE.
One of the things I like about your paper is you kind of incorporate fiction writing as inspiration. Can you kind of talk about how we can use that in sort of our technical writing and adopt some of those ideas?
Sure. I mean, and I'd say, you know, even more than inspiration, I'm looking to copy, because we constantly talk in our business about storytelling, the importance of storytelling. Well, who tells a story better than John Grisham? I mean, if you want to know how to tell a story, ask a storyteller. And so I've drawn a lot of, I feel like I've gotten a lot of great ideas. Both, another place, by the way, that I look is journalists. I think journalists are excellent storytellers, but I look at writers like Grisham, for example. Early on when I started doing this, one of the things that struck me was the beginning to The Firm, you know, because The Firm had such a great plot idea. This idea of a, you know, mob-controlled law firm in Memphis. And it was just such an intriguing plot idea. But if you remember the opening pages of The Firm, Grisham didn't start with that. In fact, that was revealed to us quite a ways into the book, right? He drew us in through the character of Mitchell McDeer. The first thing he did was introduce us to that very interesting character. And I started turning that around in my head a little bit, thinking, you know, truthfully, the law in the abstract is dull, even to judges and lawyers, right? What breathes life into the law is the way it affects people. People and their legal problems are incredibly compelling. The statute is not so terribly compelling, right? And I sort of was juxtaposing that thought against what Grisham did, realizing same principle. He realizes that what makes the story compelling is the way it affects the character. And so that was when I really began having this idea of looking at fiction writers to see how they engage their readers. Another one I really like, as you probably gathered from the paper, is Robert B. Parker, who wrote the Spencer mystery novels. And the other thing about some of these guys is they're just good, you know, that sort of thing aside, they're just technically good writers. Parker was just a magnificent, you know, whether you like the books or not, his writing skill was just off the charts. I mean, he was a brilliant writer. So yeah, you know, not exclusively. I mean, read a lot of nonfiction. I've certainly probably, other than Parker and Grisham, I would say the writer that's had the most influence on me was probably Ron Chernow, Hamilton. That book set me out on a decade-long bird hunt. You know, because, and that's sort of let me finish the thought about Parker. You know, one of the things that storytelling aside, one of the things I love about Parker is his use of sentence structure. I just think he is one of the best I've ever seen in terms of varying his sentence structure, which in my view is so critical to readability. You know, not a bunch of short sentences, not a bunch of long sentences, but not for swearing, short or long sentences. You know, when I went to law school, it was no long sentences at all. Everything should be short, punch, punch, punch. It's like, no, that's not very, you know, that just kind of wears you out after a while. These a bunch of four-word sentences is not terribly readable, right? And what Parker does such a wonderful job of is mixing up his structure, his length, and his punctuation. And I really think that contributes a lot to readability. So that's really what I've drawn from him more than any.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com. One of the things that struck me about the paper was, even though you're presenting to a crowd of appellate lawyers, it doesn't limit itself to that. It's not just how to write a good brief. I really enjoyed and appreciated the fact that you start off with something that would benefit the transactional lawyers, which is, hey, guys, you know, stop using the stupid boilerplate stuff that doesn't mean anything. And let's get back to, or if we're ever there, let's get to a point where the words in the contract actually mean something. And they're not just these old crutches and we do this, of course, in legal pleadings and brief drafting all the time too. And so the advice applies equally there. But I thought it was really smart to start off with, let's just talk about overall drafting from a broader perspective in a way that really would benefit transactional lawyers, even, you know, those that weren't attending our appellate lawyer conference.
Yeah, good writing is good writing. I mean, and I actually do that. In fact, I did it just a few weeks ago for a group of realtors in Dallas. I mean, I get invited from time to time to talk to non-lawyer groups, and, you know, fewer words applies to everybody, right? I mean, as I tell people, when's the last time you put down anything, even a comic book, and said, that was great, I just wish it had been longer? I mean, it's just not a normal human reaction, right?
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I think those principles apply. And you kind of, as you say, to restate what you said earlier, Todd, it is funny how stuck we get in patterns. This is going back years ago. I was giving a presentation somewhere and I mentioned, I forget what, it was like the redundancy you see in settlement agreements that you covenant and agree. I think it was covenant and agree. And I said, couldn't we just do one or the other? Like, I feel like I can agree or I can covenant and I'm pretty much, anyway, I was just making a joke. Well, somebody came down to me afterward and gave me the history of it. And they said, actually, I know where that started. And it was there's some nuance between English and French in this area. And he said, it started during English-French treaties. And to resolve the nuance in translation, they used both because it made it clear in both languages. And so ever since then, I've said, so those of you who conclude a lot of English-French wars, you go ahead and keep doing it. But the rest of us are going to either covenant or agree, just one or the other.
Right. Well, I mean, we're not going to go through the paper point by point, but there are a few things that I've noticed that I would like to chat with you about. For one, you mentioned, I mean, there are a few tools that legal writers, especially legal writers writing for today's judiciary, as you point out, can use to really distill information down in a really concise way. And you mentioned tables in the paper, but I don't think I saw in the paper much reference to photographs or other kinds of images. We had pretty early on, we had Mark Trachtenberg come on the show and talk about his paper about actually including images. It seems like tables can do a lot to really distill that information down, like in a super complex case, for example. But do you have any different view on photos, or you just kind of take it on a case-by-case basis, or what's your general approach to that?
I'm a huge believer in showing anytime you can show. And Adobe, you know, just gives wonderful opportunities to do that. One of the best I've seen was Rob Gilbreth, who I'm sure you guys know from Dallas. Rob did a brief in a case a few years ago, and I don't remember exactly what the case involved, but it was somebody had donated property to the city but restricted its use, like to a recreational facility, and the city wanted to use it for a library or something. And there was this whole fight about what's a recreational facility. And at the beginning of the brief, I mean, the very introduction, Rob wrote, "One of these things is not like the others." And then he had a photo of like a golf course, a baseball diamond, and the inside of a library. And I just thought, yeah, you know, there's a perfect, like, oh my gosh, is that a great use of photographs? But yeah, I mean, I spoke to I don't even know exactly, in San Antonio, these are the people who kind of helped the Zoning and Planning Commission. They're not lawyers, but this is what they did. When they were talking about various descriptions of places in the city, they were using all of these legal descriptions. And I'm like, can't you just take a picture on a map now? Doesn't Adobe allow you just to plop that in there, right? So no, I'm a huge believer. Like anytime you can show rather than tell, I think it's, you know, 100 times more powerful. I'm not as good at it as some other people are, but I'm always an admirer when I see people do that effectively. I think, oh, I wish I was better at that.
I think your reference to tables in the paper really is more geared toward tables of contents and the index of authorities, which in your, it's a very short point that you make. Basically, it's to not miss an opportunity for advocacy, especially in longer briefs, because when you open that table of contents and you see issues presented and nothing after that, you know, it does seem like that's a missed opportunity, especially in a complex case.
Absolutely. And don't take them, you know, my feeling is always take a minute to look at your headers, not in the context of the brief, but in the context of the table of contents. It's a standalone document. Because one of the things I find in my writing, and you may too, is I'll do headers in my statement of facts that with the flow of the brief make perfect sense if you're reading the brief, but sometimes sort of skip a step. If you're just looking at the table of contents, it's like one goes to two and you're like, whoa, wait a minute, where did that come from? So I think it's always important to remember somebody might be looking at the table of contents first.
Yeah. No, it's almost like you can, going back to your storytelling point, I mean, you can sort of set the posts for the story right then and there. And I do think I've heard a lot of judges say that, you know, that's one of the first things they look at is that table of contents. So again, it just goes down to even writing. You may write what seems to flow in the argument or in the statement of facts, but taking that step back to look at the headings and make sure that they read, that they convey something independently of what's in the body of your brief is a really great point. I just think that's good advice.
Yeah. My sister frequently accuses her husband of, he'll tell a story and omit a critical transitory fact. She'll say, oh, great. Now that doesn't make sense. Oh, I get it. You kind of left that middle piece out. And sometimes when I'll look at my fact headers in the table of contents, I'll realize, oh, there's a missing piece there. It's in the brief, but you would never figure it out looking at. So I do. I really do try to make sure that someone could look at the table of contents and follow the sequence. Mm-hmm.
How do you number your headings? Do you use just Roman numerals, or do you start with Arabic? And
oh, here's my thing, Todd. My bitterness toward the amount of time I spent in elementary school learning Roman numerals. Between that and the freaking metric system, I am so angry. Because I tell people, look, I don't know about you. I use that. We spent like 3 weeks on Roman numerals, and I use it one time a year because I know what Super Bowl it is, right? That is literally the only day of the year I use that 3 weeks of my life is to figure out what Super Bowl it is. No, I don't. I use good old-fashioned. I don't even call them Arabic. I call them good old-fashioned American numbers and no Roman numerals. Like it's just like, ugh, I don't even get me started.
I'm trying to break myself of the Roman numeral habit. So it's good to hear that you do that. And so I guess even in the statement of facts, clearly you would use good old-fashioned American numbers in the argument. But you use the same style in the statement of facts when you're setting out a heading in the facts section.
I do. You know, and I try not to over number things. You know, like sometimes I feel like that can get a little bit confusing by the time we get down to the little lowercase Roman numeral 4 in italics kind of thing. And sometimes I'll just center without a number if I'm doing that, like just to give a little white space and direction. But I just too many numbers, I think. Too many numbers and letter headings sometimes can get a little bit confusing.
You know, talking about numbering, have you started numbering your briefs sequentially now that we're doing full PDF? You know, page one is the first page of your brief all the way down, or do you kind of number your table of contents and then start page one on the statement of facts?
That would require him to use Romanettes.
That's true. Didn't think about that.
I think we know the answer. Chad's already given us the answer.
Yes.
And it's interesting because we've had that discussion in our office recently. We're trying, I think, to bring everyone into the 21st century and kind of do away with Romanettes. Because getting back again, Chad, I want to hear your thoughts on this, but getting back again to, you know, trying to sync up what our modern day judges want and find useful. Pagination that matches what Adobe says, what is the page number that you're on, I think makes a whole lot of sense.
It does.
Yeah.
So, you know, I agree, first of all, but there's certain things I've thought over the years I opt to play it safe on. So regardless of how I feel about it. So for example, the split infinitive, that's one I get asked about all the time. So, okay, is it really okay to split an infinitive? Of course it is. But you'll never offend anyone by not splitting infinitives. And there are still judges out there that it's like nails on a chalkboard. So even though I think it is perfectly okay to do, I don't ever do it. There's just certain aspects of writing I think fall into that category where I'm trying to think, you know, citations and footnotes. I have long, complicated feelings about that, but my easiest bottom line answer is you're never going to make anyone mad by putting them in the text because that's the convention. And there are some people you'll make mad by putting them in the footnotes. So I'm going to put them in the text regardless of my personal feeling.
Contractions?
Oh, I try not to make a habit of it, but and this is just the bad attitude in me.
The legal rebel.
Yes, that's the one play it safe where I just go, screw you, get on board. Like, you know, stop it. But boy, it's
more effective.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
And natural. I mean, sometimes it just sounds stilted, not to you. So right. Again, I try not to do it too frequently, but yes, I absolutely use contractions.
You know, while we're down in this topic, I don't want to put you on the spot, and I don't know if you have your paper with you, but you spent some time talking about the judicial preference survey and kind of some of your takeaways from that. Can you kind of hit some of the high points from that?
Oh my gosh, I don't have it in front of me if I can remember. So, oh, here's a few things that just, and if you have it there and if there's something you want to zero in on and talk about, that's fine. What I remember from the surveys, one of the things I remember is how candid the judges were with me about what they do and do not read. That struck me. They were very honest, and I was not expecting them to be. Well, let me back up. The first thing that struck me was how many of them returned the survey. Because I had a couple of friends who were judges, and they said, we get these surveys every day. No one's going to respond. No, we got an 80% plus response rate, which told me that the trial court judges really do care about the legal writing they get. And they basically said they make an effort. They either read or want/try to read every dispositive motion and response. They almost never read a motion to compel and respond. A few of them wrote me and said, you know, if somebody goes to the trouble of filing a written response, I might go back and read it. But by and large, I'm not reading. They all almost uniformly said, the earlier you get it in, the greater the chances I will read it. And I think the mistake lawyers make is thinking in terms of, well, okay, I'm going to get it in 7 days ahead of time. That's plenty of time to read a 12-page brief. And it is, unless you have 52 12-page briefs lined up in front of it, right? So the earlier it's in, the more likely it is they'll read. They can't stand when we snipe at each other. That was by far the most frequent comment I got. That was the number one comment was stop behaving like ninth grade children.
And yet.
And yet. That's right. We just can't help ourselves. You know, in fact, I moderated a judicial panel a few years ago at the Hispanic National Bar Conference, and we had a really engaging judge from the Third Circuit, I believe. Fourth Circuit, Richmond. And he kind of, beforehand, we were talking about that very point. And he said, well, my gosh, you're a high school principal. What's it like when you have two ninth graders in your office arguing? He said, that's exactly the same thing.
Here's one that I think is interesting is gender neutral language. You want to talk about that a little bit? Because you do talk about that in your paper too.
So, you know, you get, and I don't even remember what the survey said about that.
They expressed a preference for it.
So gender neutral language, I just try to avoid it if I can. Unless I'm talking about a specific person who actually has a gender, you know, if I'm talking about sort of a hypothetical person, I will go to pretty great lengths just to try to avoid any reference to gender of any type. Because again, I think no matter which way you go, well, why'd you say he? Well, then why'd you say she? Well, then why didn't you say he or she? Which is, you know.
Yeah.
So I'll pretty much just take it out. But yes, I think, again, if you continually use the masculine, particularly in an age where so many of our judges are women, and so many of our male judges are sensitive to that issue, I think it's you're going to get yourself into some trouble. I didn't even remember that was in the survey. It's been so long since I.
Yeah, I know. I'm kind of catching you here with asking you to have something that you don't have in front of you. But I think that these are all helpful things to remember. Another one that I saw on the list that I think is always useful to reiterate is hyperbole.
Oh, my gosh. Yes, that's another one. What Professor Younger used to call the screaming adjectives.
Yeah.
And all it does is take the power. You know, we all know the most powerful statements are the simplest. I mean, there's no more powerful statement in the English language than no. Right. I mean, so I think, yes, I spend a great deal of time trying to ensure that I have none of those types of words in anything, any legal writing. Again, it goes back to the point. It's a different way of saying show rather than tell. If the argument is truly that unbelievably galactically stupid, I think you can show that and let the judge figure it out. And that it's probably more effective to do it that way anyway. If they figure it out on their own, that point is going to be driven home with far greater force, I think.
How do you, to that point, you know, let's say you've got a trial lawyer who's got a really strong opinion about how a case ought to be presented and, you know, really wants to insert that sort of hyperbolic language to try to drill the point home, other than just using your clout and credibility, you know, as Chad Baruch. How do you stem that with your trial lawyer?
It is hard, you know, mostly by buttering them up, you know. Oh my gosh, this is what makes you a great lawyer in front of the jury. This right here, but in our world, it has the exact opposite effect. The more of that language you use, the more the Court of Appeals is going to think you're trying to cover a weakness in your argument. But you're right, they get, you know, it's the same problem. I jokingly tell people that truthfully, probably the most common question I've gotten over the years is younger lawyers coming up to me afterward and saying, everything you said is what I was taught in law school. But I have this old partner who, when I do it that way, changes it all. What am I supposed to do? I always give him the same answer. Wait for him to die. What do you want from me, right? Like, if that's the person signing your paycheck, I guess that's the person you got to please. But, you know, there's kind of some truth to that. You just sometimes have these generational issues that are hard to get people past. I just got one from a trial lawyer in a case I'm working with this week that started comes now. Really? I didn't know anybody still did that.
Oh, they do.
Why now and not later or earlier
or maybe 50 years ago?
Yeah.
It's just in some way. So a few years ago, Lynn Liberato asked me if I would do a presentation at the, whatever that's called, the Texas Supreme Court Historical CLE, you know, where they do kind of the one day of Supreme Court practice and the one day of history. And on the history day, so they asked me to go pull some Texas Supreme Court briefs from the late 1800s. And early 1900s out of archives and just talk about what briefs were like back then. And interestingly enough, I will tell you, some of them are better than some of the briefs we read today. I mean, it was pretty amazing how well written and simply written some of those briefs were 110 years ago. And by the way, by total coincidence, the very first one I pulled out of the box was a petition for review by Baker Botts from like 1892.
Oh my gosh, how funny.
Hilarious.
Do they read better than the court opinions from that time? Because it's really difficult for me to get through one of those court opinions.
Yes. And some of them don't. Believe me, there was plenty of, and some of them, there was no limitation back then. Now, interestingly enough, back then, the court didn't do merits briefing. You did your petition for review, and if the court took the case, then they ordered the briefing from the Court of Appeals.
Oh, interesting.
And relied on that. So it was, yeah, a little different procedure, but some of the briefs, there was one, I can't think what the case was, but the briefing ran to like, you know, it was three volumes. The brief was literally three volumes. It was like 300 pages or something. It was like, wow, that's a lot to.
And not a great judicious use of headings, I wouldn't gather either.
Yes, it was, gosh, I can't believe. I mean, it was a huge case, but, and it, I mean, the appendix had all sorts of Spanish law in it, and it was kind of, I think it was a water rights case.
Oh, wow.
But there really was some great writing back then.
That's interesting.
Well, I have to ask you about a couple other topics in the paper, especially given your reputation as the hip-hop lawyer, the hip-hop brief lawyer. But you do talk about not only pop culture references, but also literary references, which is something that we tend to see. There are some courts that tend to like to include those things, whether they actually make the opinions better or not is a subject for debate. But I think you give some solid advice in the paper, and certainly would love to hear you just quickly give your perspective on that.
Yeah, and that's something, you know, again, my perspective on that has changed over the years somewhat, certainly since I wrote the paper. I know there, you know, we're seeing some appellate courts where that's becoming more and more common, and particularly certain judges where that's becoming more and more common. And then we've seen, I think, Jody, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was the Fort Worth Court of Appeals who kind of slapped a lawyer for doing that recently.
Maybe so, I don't know.
I think so. It was one of the intermediate courts, and I think it was Fort Worth, that sort of said, you know, there was a reference, a cultural reference, and basically said, we're not sure how that helps advance our decision in this case or something. So, you know, I think caution remains the watchword. In my view, with the ever younger judiciary, if you're going to use cultural references, you need to be universal. As I sort of jokingly, I think I said this during the Buzz Lightyear seminar, your Bob Dylan reference may not resonate with some of these judges. They may get your Jay-Z reference. And in fact, I had a brief I did last year, the year before, in the Dallas Court of Appeals, where I decided to drop one of those. And I actually double cited the Eagles and Jay-Z. I thought, I'm covering all my bases.
That's right.
But, you know, there are just times. Sometimes you do it to be clever or cute and show, you know, how smart we are. And those are probably the wrong times to do it, right? Even though we all may do it. But sometimes you can convey more with a reference like that than with two pages of argument. You know, and the classic example I give people is during his confirmation hearing, when John Roberts was asked his philosophy, his judicial philosophy, and he said, call balls and strikes. That is, he could have talked for 10 minutes and not said as much as he said, call balls and strikes. You know, so sometimes you really can. You know, Bob Dylan, you don't need a weatherman to tell you which way the wind is blowing. If you're arguing about the need for an expert, that, you know, that's pretty good. And again, we talk about storytellers like Grisham. Well, what do people like Springsteen and Dylan do? They take the human experience and reduce it to three or four lines of lyrics. I mean, this is what makes them geniuses. So I think there, you know, my point is there is wisdom in there to be had at times as well. You know, as long as you're not being silly about it. And some, I will tell you, lawyers go crazy for it. There's a judge down in Florida who's written a book about the use of rock music citations in judicial opinions. He's an appellate judge in Florida, Mark Clayton Smith. And we did an article together for the Wisconsin Bar Journal. And, you know, it was fun. It was just an article on published Wisconsin appellate opinions citing rock and roll lyrics. So it was not perhaps the most scholarly article, but we like just won some award from the Wisconsin Bar Journal because the lawyers voted it like one of the five most popular articles of the year or something. So, you know, people really do enjoy, as long as you're not being silly about it, I think it people seem to enjoy it. And it's amazing. We have some judges in Texas who really cite a lot of rock and roll lyrics in their
opinion. Really? I hadn't done a survey, but that's interesting.
It is.
I did an article for The Advocate on it. And like Brian Quinn, the chief up in Amarillo, he's a big Grateful Dead citer. And then Sam Lindsay, our federal judge in Dallas, has done it a number of times, and a little bit wider array in Texas. You know, most states, the reality is it's almost all the Beatles, Dylan, and Springsteen. Right. We have a little broader, we get some Willie Nelson in there in Texas.
Well, that's perfectly appropriate.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we could just talk all day long about various topics in this paper. I'll refer one more time to the paper, and then I want to ask a question. My reference in the paper is is what I think is one of the things that's great about you, Chad, is the very last line, which is everything in this paper may be wrong. A little dose of humility there at the end. Clearly knows what he's talking about when it comes to legal writing and is able to present on what some might may find to be a rather pedestrian topic in a very engaging way. I mean, anybody who's willing to put on a Buzz Lightyear costume to present in front of 300 appellate lawyers has got a healthy sense of self. And I admire that. But if it's okay with you, I'd love to link the paper with our show and post a copy, make it available to folks. And we'll try and do that. But the question I wanted to ask to wrap up, I think, is really something that I would like to know the answer to. And is it, if someone who not only maybe someone isn't going to read this paper, clearly there's a lot of good tips in here on how to improve one's legal writing. But if someone wasn't going to read the paper, what advice would you give someone who came to you and said, hey, what's the best way for me to improve my legal writing?
Number one, I probably answer two ways. I mean, that's sort of an in the abstract, maybe three ways. Three ways, three quick answers. Write for the reader, not for yourself. Mistake I made as a young appellate lawyer was everything I wrote read like a law review article, because that's just the way my brain works. And so write for the audience, number one. Number two, in terms of like technical writing, I'd say the easiest thing you can do immediately to make the most improvement in your writing is focus on your verbs. I think that's just the most, you know, if you want to have a transformative effect, get rid of the be verbs, get rid of is, and plug dynamic verbs in. And that will have a twofold effect. It will make the writing more powerful, and it will also make you realize that you'll start taking out adjectives because all the punch is going to be in the verbs. And that's a good place, right? The verbs, that's moving the action. So it's perfectly appropriate to use powerful, punchy verbs, and no one thinks you're trying to oversell, right? And then just make it shorter, for heaven's sake, have mercy, for the love of God, have mercy, and make it shorter. You know, those would be probably my biggest takeaways. And then just watch what other good writers are doing.
As you were saying that, I was thinking, you know, people who read a lot, I think reading can really add a lot to your writing skill. And I know that's something, Chad, that you believe in too, because we've talked a lot about books that you find persuasive, and you know, you're a big advocate of that. One of the things that we like to do as we wrap up our sessions with guests is to have them offer up a tip or a war story. I mean, a lot of this discussion has been about tips, but as we get ready to close out our time together today, was there a tip or a war story that came to mind that you'd like to part with?
Not really. You know, the only thing I'll say is, you know, you kind of cited the everything in this paper may be wrong. The only thing that always occurs to me is there are no right answers here. And a lot of really good lawyers disagree vehemently on a lot of these topics. I just last year had one more phenomenal opportunity to co-counsel, and I was working with Paul Clement on a case in the U.S. Supreme Court. And what people may not realize is that Paul and I we're the same age, and we grew up very close to each other in Wisconsin. And we were both high school debaters in the same class of 84 in the state of Wisconsin, which is not the biggest state in the world. So we were high school debate competitors. And I tell people, I am proud to be the second best appellate lawyer produced by the public school system in the state of Wisconsin in 1984. I'll never get to be number one, but nobody's taken number two away from me. But he's a big two spaces between sentence guy. I'm like, are you kidding me right now? Like, you're like the best appellate lawyer on the planet, and you're doing the one thing that I find just the most egregious, offensive. Like, and boy, he and I actually was arguing in a CLE with his partner, Aaron Murphy. And, you know, they had a pretty good day at the Supreme Court yesterday. And Aaron just went toe to toe with me. She's like, yeah, we're not backing down on this one. We're two space people. So all of these things are, you know, open to disagreement and discussion.
That's a great point.
By the way, I was the better high school debater. I might not be the better appellate lawyer, but I was the better high school debater.
And in the end, isn't that what really matters?
That's right. We can end with that note, Chad. It's a great place to wrap up with you putting yourself ahead of Paul Clement. So thanks for being with us. We really appreciate the time today.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, thanks for having me, guys. It was very enjoyable. By the way, it's the first podcast I've ever participated in or even listened to.
Well, I'm glad that you're a part of it. Thank you so much.
And now having done it, knowing what a podcast is, I'm going to have to listen to your podcast.
Okay. Well, we appreciate that.
We'd love to have you do that and maybe come back sometime.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.